Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Spencer Keeble.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today, Alexis Goldsmith interviews three women who are involved with Extinction Rebellion in the Capital Region. Then Elizabeth Press speaks with Troy community members about their reactions to candidates for city council and mayor. After that, on Climate Matters, Peter Savio speaks with Kate Boycourt of the Waterfront Alliance. Then on Upstate Housing, Michelle Masurgeon speaks with Anthony Mohan as the Legal Aid Network of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. And then to close out the show, Chris Scully speaks with Emilia Morgana of Extinction Rebellion. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that an administrative law judge has upheld a federal OSHA fine against Tony Watson, a Schenectady owner of Countryside Tree Service, and ordered him to pay a fine of $67,000 following the death of an employee who was pulled into one of his wood chippers. The judge said Watson knew that employees should be trained to work with the wood chipper, but allowed 23-year-old Justice Booz, who was not trained, to work with it anyway on his first day on the job.
The State Public Service Commission expects New York State heating prices will be lower this winter than last year unless there is a major cold spell. Average gas prices last year ran $831 for the heating season, but are expected to fall to $757 this year due to imported natural gas from hydrofracking in Pennsylvania. Reduced gas prices have been shown to increase the use of gas and to encourage the construction of gas-fired infrastructure, both of which contribute to carbon dioxide emissions, which cause global warming.
In Politico today, a long-delayed report has been released that evaluates clean drinking water options for the Hoosick Falls area, where the public supply and private wells were contaminated with the PFOA. The report, prepared by the companies being held responsible for the pollution and reviewed by the DEC, is subject to public comment until November 18th. The report identifies five potential options. Two involve the continued use of the current wells and ongoing filtration to remove PFOA. Two other options offered were directly tapping into the Tom Hanek Reservoir and hooking into the Troy Municipal System.
The New York State Department of Health put out several studies this week which identified Glens Falls and Buffalo, among other areas, as having unusually high rates of cancer, but concluded that it was due to personal lifestyle, smoking and obesity, rather than environmental factors such as air pollution. While state health officials recommend a number of general principles for reducing cancer rates, such as promoting healthy eating and encouraging smokers to quit, it's vague on how local stakeholders should implement these recommendations.
For those of you just tuning in, we're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Spencer Keeble.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, send an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That's hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Next up, correspondent Alexis Goldsmith sat down with three Capital District women who are part of Extinction Rebellion. In part one, Janelle, Nika, and Megan discuss XR's philosophy of regenerative culture.
This is HMM correspondent Alexis Goldsmith, and I have with me in the studio today three women in XR. Welcome to the studio. Do you mind introducing yourselves?
Thank you for having us. My name is Nika Horvitz.
Hi, I'm Janelle Fish.
And I'm Megan Marone.
Could you explain your roles in XR?
Sure. This is Nika. I have been involved in since the spring when a number of us got together to try to start an Extinction Rebellion chapter in the Capital Region. That eventually ended up having multiple working groups, and I'm in the Regenerative Culture Working Group as well as the Media and Messaging Working Group. And each working group sends representatives into a separate working group, which is sort of the overall coordinating group, and I'm also in that group.
This is Janelle, and I joined Extinction Rebellion about a month ago. I am not in any working groups, though I think I'm about to be recruited as of tomorrow. That's, you know, otherwise I'm just showing up for actions at this point.
And I'm Megan, and I'm in Regenerative Culture, the Regenerative Culture Circle of XR, and I joined in January after two friends had done background research on Extinction Rebellion, which was really useful, and then came back to Troy and told a whole bunch of people about how we can get involved.
Let's set the foundation for the interview. What is regenerative culture in XR? What do they mean by that?
I can take a stab at it. Regenerative culture looks at how to create healthy and resilient communities of people working together towards system change, recognizing that many of the systems that sort of dominate our lives are incredibly damaging to ourselves and that we damage and harm each other as well as the natural world. So regenerative culture tries to put in systems and processes that sort of counter that, both new systems and reconnecting to older ways of doing that.
It's tricky but it's also, I think, one of the most exciting aspects of XR because basically what it's the hyper differentiation from other environmentalist movements, I would say. And also I'm thinking back to my experience in terms of other activist work or protests, and there's this focus on individual human beings' emotional life and well-being, and then the question of how you create a healthy community built into Extinction Rebellion with the regenerative culture segment of XR. And so it's a real challenge to organize with this mission of we're not only going to interrupt the systems that are extremely destructive with protests and other nonviolent direct actions, but also build the world that we want to see. That was a really exciting part of Occupy Wall Street, the critique of Occupy Wall Street being that it was so ephemeral and, like, you know, it was only in Zuccotti Park for a certain amount of time. And yet I think that that whole idea for whatever amount of time of even just playing at the world that you wish you were in is really important, and just a space that adults don't really get very much. But I think that more and more there's just such a need for authenticity in terms of emotions and reckoning with power and questions of community.
So it's 100 years in the future, and XR's mission has succeeded. What does regenerative culture look like?
If I can speak to that. I think for me, that looks like the things that Extinction Rebellion lays out. There's five aspects of care, and that looks like caring for yourself. That's caring for other people taking part in whatever the movement is. So if we've succeeded with Extinction Rebellion, I don't know what we're moving toward, but I bet there's something that's going to need action behind it. There's caring for the relationships that you're in, so interpersonal care and making sure that you're taking responsibility for your role in all of the various relationships that you take part in within your family, within your workplace, within your community. There's community care. How we take care of the development as a network, strengthening our connections and adherence to the principles that we all hold to, and then caring for the people and the planet that we're fighting for. So one of my frustrations as an activist for, 20 years now has been that we always get really fired up about things for a brief time, and this might be maybe what you're referencing with Occupy Wall Street. We can do it for a little while and then we burn out, and then we're like, oh God, we did it again. Like we fired up and then we burned out. And what's different, I think, about Extinction Rebellion is that so many people are looking out to make sure that that's not happening. So in 100 years, we have a system where we're used to doing that. We're it's part of our nature, and we're doing it automatically instead of right now where we've been programmed asleep and we're not really caring about anybody, including ourselves, I would say.
I find it interesting that you talk about taking responsibility for your emotions. Do you see XR's mission tie in with the suffragette movement and with reconciling toxic male masculinity?
Yeah, I think in a perfect world, in a perfect XR, there's like so much work to do there, and like we're working against everything. And I don't mean us three people in this interview, but just as people aligned with similar value systems and feelings about wanting to be taking care. I mean, maybe I'll shift gears and say that one thing I'd add to Janelle's 100 years forward, I mean, playing off of the last thing you said, is like, for me, regenerative culture in the future is a completely different and a very old and what I feel to be a very natural relationship to the earth of like reciprocity and, you know, like serving the earth. And that to me is very oppositional to, yeah, patriarchal white supremacy that we are completely living in all ways. So in that way, yes, I think Extinction Rebellion, you know, that's the vision. We're still living in this world as it is right now, and it plays out that way in all sorts of ways.
Patriarchy is the oldest system, really, and we're in such a strange time in terms of the way that, you know, basically corporate oligarchy taking over, you know, you just have like corporatism everywhere. And so it's this particular flavor of patriarchy, which denies death. So like, yeah, when Nika was just talking about reciprocity with the earth, things come and go on planet Earth, you know, like things are born and then they die. And so I think we're living in such strange times in terms of the promise of virtual immortality and accelerationist capitalist ideas that could be fused with like a new technological wonderland. And yet the reality is that the systems around us are crumbling and failing, and that also even abstract concepts like freedom are really, you know, if people really challenged what freedom actually means in 2019, 2020, you know, they would find that, you know, we are so restricted within these systems. And then you have something like the crackdown that's happening in London right now of the, you know, the authorities just saying like, nope, no more Extinction Rebellion. And like, that should be the wake up call to everybody that, you know, these actions are necessary and threatening the establishment. So yeah, it does seem like the regenerative culture part of XR is about addressing people's emotional needs, and that's like, it's so needed, but it's also a response to this kind of overwhelming corporate technological capitalism that is patriarchy. It's the current flavor of patriarchy on Earth.
I would just add, if that's okay, just sort of a shout out to the structure of Extinction Rebellion, which is, it's called self-organizing systems or holacracy or sociocracy. There's different versions of its name or maybe versions of itself, but it is a decentralized structure. And I have found it to be the first sort of movement of this kind where I felt myself kind of finding a more organic place to fit in. And I think that that is also something that is sort of working in opposition to patriarchy and sort of hierarchical structures that we're used to, definitely in activism as well as the rest of the world.
Well, we've been speaking with Nika, Janelle, and Megan, who are all XR activists. This is part one.
That was Alexis with Janelle, Nika, and Megan from Extinction Rebellion.
On Wednesday, October 16th, the Troy Neighborhoods Action Council, or TNAC, sponsored a Meet the Candidates event featuring candidates for mayor and city council. In this next piece, WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press gets reactions to the event from participants.
I'm Marie Gavazzi. The Troy Neighborhood Actions Council is an association of the neighborhood groups in Troy. We sponsored this event every 2 years because we feel it's so important to inform the voters about the positions of the candidates so they can make a good decision in voting.
And can you just tell me a little bit about tonight, how it's organized, who comes out to this sort of event?
People come from all over Troy, and the candidates are always most appreciative of having the opportunity. This is the only event at which candidates for the city council are able to be compared with one another. The mayor race usually has other opportunities and certainly has this year. We invite everyone who is on the ballot. We've started having separate district rooms because we feel that maximizes the time that people have with the candidates for whom they have to vote. If we were to have everybody all in one room, it would really reduce the amount of time that each candidate had. So for the different districts, we break into the classrooms, which is one of the reasons that we use an educational setting, because they do have the rooms that we can do that in. And then for the citywide races, we have that in just one room where everybody can see the candidates. Actually, District 2, as the host district for this event, was put in the gym as far as their location, but the other five races were upstairs.
For you personally, what's the value of having this?
Mike Esposito from Little Italy did this to begin with, and he asked for help, and I volunteered, and the next year he didn't do it, so I've been doing it since. And I started because I didn't know the candidates for whom I wanted to vote, and I was seeking more information. So that's how I became involved in organizing this.
And what's the importance of voting in a small city like Troy?
Personally, I feel that I can have much more of an impact on the local level than I can on the national level. And I'm very affected by what happens here in Troy. So I like to participate in this in order to be able to vote and have that impact.
My name is Suzanne Spellen. I was a facilitator for District 2 for the candidates to discuss the issues. And I was very happy to do it. I think it's very important that people see and hear and talk to the representatives face-to-face in small groups and get the real questions out. And I hope that we were able to do that tonight. And that goes for the mayor and all the other elected officials as well.
In your District 2 breakout, was there a question that a community member asked that really spoke to you?
There were a lot of specific questions about specific parts of D2 that are in deep trouble, and it was good to hear what both candidates said about how they would try to fix some of the really pressing social issues that we've got.
My name's Alfonso Hicks, and we're from live on 9th Street. And my reaction is, whatever they say, they always put Lansing Burke or either downtown Troy first, never Central Troy. See, the downtown Lansing Burke, then Central Troy. When do we come first? When?
What are the most pressing issues on 9th Street?
Lights. Lights deter crime and violence. They need lights. They need sidewalks. People walking in the street, a girl got hit on 8th Street, walking in the street, probably because the sidewalk was no good. They really need to do something there. They want to do it everywhere else. They want to rebuild Monument Square. It was a brand new building. They tore it down. Now they want to redo it again. For what? Just money wasted. That's the way I feel.
My name is Ronnie Shamam. I live in District 4, downtown Troy. Beautiful, historic downtown Troy. And I think that events like this are very important when the community gets to hear and feel the tone of the candidates. So I went to the candidates for district and for the mayoral. I'm impressed by all of them, quite frankly. They all had passion. They all love Troy. And now we have to make a decision. Troy is a new home for me. I left here and came back after 50 years. And now I'm getting involved in the community, and it's very rich for me to be able to hear the progress that's been made. And I'm looking forward to many years of more progress in this city, especially in North Central and Lansingburg. I'd like to see the improvements, but I think that the momentum is there.
My name is Shaquem Francis, and I'm 15 years old. And my reaction to meet the candidates tonight so far, it definitely made me a lot more interested in politics and like what's going on in the actual world around us. And I'm actually very impressed about how much the candidates actually were able to touch upon all of their questions by the audience and how much detail and empathy they give to their answers.
If you could ask the candidates a question, what would you ask? What's important to you?
What's really important to me is being able to express yourself, because like in society, there is a lot of gender and stereotypical norms. And so maybe, like, what would they do to make people more comfortable, like, in their everyday life, to make kids more inspired to be themselves in this society.
My name is John Johansson. I came tonight actually because I was asked to facilitate the District 6 breakout room, which I've been doing for about 10 years.
10 years, that's a long time. Why is it important for you to do this type of thing?
You know, I've been doing it for that long, and as a person of privilege, I'd actually reached out and tried to see if there were any other, like, you know, people that could do it this year, and we couldn't find anybody, so I guess I'm doing it once more. You know, my district is extremely diverse, like racially, economically, and so forth, and I'd really like to see someone else in that position going forward.
What do you think is important about having this type of event, Meet the Candidates event in Troy?
We live in a pretty crazy democracy. You know, we're a country of like 300 million people. Decisions at like state and federal levels are done, in rooms and in spaces that are so detached from our daily lives. And I think cities have like enormous power in the world that is generally underutilized. So, you know, becoming more involved in our city decision making, using cities as like, you know, testing grounds to test out democratic concepts and also like start to build power like a local base, I think is really important. So I think these kind of meetings are critical. Unfortunately, I think, you know, looking at the room, it's demographically very thin. So I think like we need to do a lot better outreach to get like a more representative sample of the community into these spaces.
My name is Deborah Garrett. I'm the district council person for District 2. My reaction is I feel like a lot of these answers are like premeditated and don't feel like is they're getting to the core of things. I can't speak for the whole city, but I can speak for this particular area. District 2, it feels like it's the lowest district right now. There's a lot of people with all these great ideas, but nobody's actually doing the work. The two ladies that's running for my district, I don't feel like they answer the question that I would like to hear. At the end of the day, I'm a taxpayer as well, and everybody's focused on Lansingburg. And when they speak of North Central and Hillside, all you hear about is the nasty garbage and the crimes. There's some good things going on. In particular, you're in a great building that is letting you use their space. Troy Prep is awesome. You're using their space, so that's something good to talk about. School 2 have a lot of good things going on. You have the Art Charter community, the after-school program. Those are good things that's happening in the community, so always hearing about the violence and the trash, I'm over that. If you want to help North Central, give these teenagers from 13 to 21 something to do after school hours.
You just mentioned that the people running in District 2 didn't answer your questions. What do you want them to answer?
I just want them to be, so Kim is very visible. I will give her that. She's very visible. Mary seemed like she's a good person, but I don't see her as often. My thing is I need people to be out in the community when they're not just running, and I need people to be out in the community actually talking to people that are not just the big mouths of the communities, right? So talk to the regular person walking up and down the block. So have they ever been here besides for tonight? Have they been up the block to the Snug to talk to those guys? You know, things like that. Have they been to the corner store and the laundromat up the block and talk to those guys? That's the thing that I think that they need to focus on. It's great that Mary was on the Lansingburg School District, but there's other things in this area that needs to be, you know, handled. So
great. Anything else you want to say?
I think that the voters need to pay attention, and not just for my district and District 2. I think they need to pay attention to everything that's happening around them. And you need to make your vote based on what is needed for the whole community and not just for what you feel is important. I'm not for the party. Although I'm a registered Democrat, I'm for the people. If it makes sense to me and it's for the community, then that's what I'm going for. And I think that the city of Troy, the residents of Troy, need to focus on that as well.
Thank you. Last question. You are running this time, do you plan to stay engaged with city politics?
So my goal, honestly, after 2019, I'm going to go full steam ahead. I'm pushing into the Democratic committee. You're going to hear my voice. You're going to see my face, and I'm bringing everybody else with me, because this is a shame that you don't have nobody of color on that committee. And it's a shame that you're allowing people that are working for the Board of Election running for seats. I don't agree with that. So yes, this is not the end of Deborah Garrett. Deborah, you will be seeing her probably more than you see her now, because I'm going to bring a whole lot of people. We're coming in full steam ahead.
That was Elizabeth Press speaking to participants of the TNAC-sponsored event on October 16th. The Hudson Mohawk Magazine will be airing one-on-one interviews with the candidates until elections on November 5th.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Spencer Keeble. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. That's 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
On this week's episode of Climate Matters, Peter Savio speaks with Kate Bocart, Director of Resilience at the Waterfront Alliance.
Welcome to Climate Matters. We are here for segment 3 of a discussion with Kate Bocart of the Waterfront Alliance. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Peter.
Excellent. Wonderful to have you join us again. We've been discussing the challenges and prospects for collaborating and learning more about the risks of sea level rise and other impacts from climate, and how adaptation can fill an important role in preparing for and developing resiliency in local communities. Kate, I wonder if we could start out by having you tell us how listeners can learn more about the Waterfront Alliance and learn more about adaptation and how they might become involved.
Sure. Yeah. So as I think that will be on your website or waterfrontalliance.org, you can kind of go there and find out more. And as pretty soon, actually, we'll have a more we'll have a website that will have an update on a place where you can sign up for updates about our developing campaign for climate resilience in the New York, New Jersey region. So you should definitely keep an eye on our website, sign up for our email list. But also there's a couple policy things that you can kind of check out now. As we were talking about, we're locked into a certain amount of sea level rise and heat, and there's a lot of issues that are pretty critical to people's ways of life as a result of that. And there's some near-term policy action actually being discussed at a national level, is National Flood Insurance Program and FEMA reform. And we've got basically a policy brief or testimony that we sent to our elected officials about that on our website. You can also kind of check out New York City and New Jersey are both in waterfront or coastal resilience planning processes. And so this is a good time to kind of check out and engage with your leaders, elected officials, and talk about these issues and talk about what you care about and what you'd like to see.
Right, right. There is so much to consider as far as resilience, access, the working waterfront, the jobs and economic vitality of our communities, whether through resorts or through shipping or through other engagement with our waterfront. We need to see that connection and consider, as you said earlier, what is the future we want to see?
And I should say on the jobs front already, and there have been estimates of how green infrastructure investments and adaptation will lead to more green jobs, but over 400,000 jobs are directly or indirectly related to our port in New York and New Jersey alone. So that just gives you a sense of what's at risk in terms of our jobs and livelihoods and economy.
Wow. So could you tell us again the extent of waterfront that exists in New York City, in the New York City region and northern New Jersey that the Waterfront Alliance is working with?
Sure. So there's about 520 miles of waterfront in New York City, and then there's about 1,600 in the tidal portions of sort of from Sandy Hook, New Jersey, in the Raritan Bay up north to the border of New York and New Jersey over to Rockaway and Jamaica Bay and the tidal waters of New York.
And you also had mentioned earlier, Kate, the Federal Flood Insurance Program and the feedback that the Waterfront Alliance provided. Could you provide a little insight into some of the high points in the feedback
Sure.
you provided?
Yeah, and I think I've probably been talking a lot about sort of big picture solutions and macro scale things that we should be doing as states and cities and towns. But in terms of homeowners or renters or small businesses, the National Flood Insurance Program is a really critical option for us. It basically is something that actually just as taxpayers we're all paying into. And essentially our federal government is a risk manager for all of these federally backed insurance policies. And we're kind of stacking the cards against ourselves, and we're deeply in debt because of the format of how it's been constructed. And we've learned a lot. There's still more to learn, but basically it's actually very hard for even a single homeowner or renter, like somebody a policyholder has. They have to annually kind of renew these insurance. There's no automatic policy. So there's ways that we can just make it simpler for people to have insurance, which is a really critical component of bouncing back after a storm, if one can really bounce back from that kind of damage. Mm-hmm. But insurance is certainly a way to help. So that's one thing. Also just really aligning risk with pricing, with exceptions for those who can't afford it based on housing burden. Those are things that we need to be thinking about, really disclosing our risk and really aligning it to what it actually is, which currently it's not. And thinking about mapping in terms of where flooding will be in the near term. Sea level rise is not incorporated, and a lot of people just don't know that. Our maps are quite out of date, and there's a lot of changes that we can do on the technical side as well as the programmatic side to improve user experience and quality of our assessments.
Mm. And for listeners who'd like to learn more about the Waterfront Alliance's input in terms of the federal flood insurance program, you can go to waterfrontalliance.org and learn more if you'd like to follow up on Kate's summary of that. Kate, as far as other recommendations and reports that the Alliance has developed, did you want to talk about the comments on the New York, New Jersey and their plans?
Sure. I think, are you referring to the study by the Army Corps of Engineers in partnership with the states?
Yeah. At first, I was referring to the New Jersey Harbor and Tributaries Coastal Storm Risk.
Right.
But I did want to get to, yes, and that's exactly at the Army Corps of Engineers with their
right.
long title of Harbor and Tributaries Coastal Storm Risk Management Feasibility Study.
Right. And that's actually part of the problem, right? It's very hard to sort of wrap your head around the title and what it means. And we've got a region with, over 10 million people living in New York and New Jersey. And the Army Corps has initiated a process starting last year to study this region for what we need to respond to a storm. And I should say that the primary focus of the study is responding to storm surge. So those storms like Sandy or Irene or Lee and not sea level rise. And that's an important distinction. They do incorporate it later on, but not from the frame of how do we decide which way to go. And that is critical because there are other regions that have, when you include the full picture of sea level rise plus storms, you get different outcomes. We communicate a lot with the Army Corps. We've been engaged in the process. And I think overall, we've realized that the process itself, they've only had about 8 to 10 public meetings in this huge area about projects that range from a storm surge gate that would go from the Barrier Island of Rockaway to Sandy Hook, as well as onshore sort of berm-like solutions. And the process is sort of fundamentally flawed if we're not having a big public conversation about what to do. Ultimately, these projects cost multiple billions of dollars, and the order of magnitude is not that much different between the different solutions, although some are more expensive than the others. And when we're talking about that kind of number, what we really should be talking about is the values that the people that live in these areas want and want to see. And I think overall, we need this kind of study. We need resources looking at these issues, but we have a long way to go before we figure out what exactly we should be doing on the ground and in the water. And that's kind of the nature of our comments, as well as some more technical comments about when you incorporate sea level rise and how important that is. And it's really not necessarily the Army Corps' fault that the resources are not there to address this issue more fully and engage. And I think there's a lot of ways that our states and federal government could be giving more resources to look at these issues, whether through the Army Corps or other means, so that we can think about how we can best align our agencies to work together and address this issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Kate. We've been discussing adaptation and the Waterfront Alliance's role in terms of adaptation, resilience, access, and the working waterfront. The most recent piece, we've talked about a couple of in-depth documents and comments that the Waterfront Alliance has shared. Where, Kate, could people learn more about the Waterfront Alliance?
Sure, you can. I mean, as I said, you can check us out on our website, waterfrontalliance.org. We're also, I'm on Twitter, Waterfront Alliance is on Twitter, at our waterfront, at Kate Boycourt. So we post about this kind of stuff, and if there's common opportunities, then we also share there. Our public policy testimony is on our website as well, so you can check that all out there.
Well, we very much appreciate your great information and sharing your insights and collaboration. Thanks again to Kate Boycourt and the Waterfront Alliance.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
That was Kate Boycourt speaking with Peter Savio on climate matters.
Next on Upstate Housing, Michelle Masurgeon speaks with Anthony Mohan from the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York.
Good day, all, and welcome to the Upstate Housing Program. My name is Michelle Masurgeon, and I will be your host, bringing you news and information regarding the struggle for decent, affordable housing in the Capital Region. Just a reminder, if you are a renter, you have the right to adequate heat. Heat must be supplied from October 1st through May 31st. So let's get on with the show. Today's show is a discussion of the Housing Stability Tenant Protection Act, which passed in June of this year. With me to discuss the act is Anthony Mohan from the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Anthony, before we jump in, what types of clients does the Legal Aid Society serve?
So we serve clients who are lower income, and that generally means under 125% of the federal poverty level. We occasionally, well, assist people who are a little bit above that level under certain grants.
Okay. So with the Housing Stability Tenant Protection Act, which I'm going to say HSTP for short, does this act cover all rental units in New York State, or is it limited? And I'm excluding discussion of the New York City region.
Right. So the changes in the law that went into effect, other than the ones that specifically applied to New York City, apply to all housing units. So all the changes to eviction procedure, they apply across the board. There were changes, like you're alluding to, specifically to the rent stabilization law, which expanded that to be statewide. So that could now be enacted by municipalities all across New York State.
With the HSTPA, we're just going to kind of jump in on some of the highlights that really affect tenants, or if you're a renter or you're looking to rent. And I think one of the first things was security deposit. So what was the change with the security deposit?
So the HSTPA included a pretty substantial revision to the security deposit law. It included a number of requirements now. For example, if a landlord wants to withhold any portion of a tenant's security deposit after that tenant has moved out, they now have a 14-day window in which to give a specified written statement of exactly what they're withholding and why. And a failure to give that written statement would be an absolute defense for the tenant if they were to bring a small claims action to recover the security deposit afterwards.
Now, is the security deposit limited to, can a landlord say, I need 2 months security deposit, and can the security deposit be used toward your last month's rent?
Generally speaking, no. I mean, the security deposit is limited to only 1 month, and there's now a restriction that that's the only advance that a landlord can require prior to moving in. So no additional deposits, no doubling it up for numerous months or things like that. As far as what it else can be applied to, the general rule is that security and rent are two different things, although you will find circumstances where the landlord and the tenant make an agreement where they'll credit last month's rent for the security deposit so that the tenant can have some additional cash to move prior to moving out.
But that would have to be an agreement between the tenant and the landlord.
Exactly.
So basically the security deposit is what it says is you still have to pay your last month's rent and then leave the apartment in good condition. So the timeline, so like you mentioning, the landlord has a specific timeline to return the security deposit. So that was a change in the law?
Right. The law, as it's framed, is that the landlord has to return the security deposit within a reasonable time. But if they're not going to return it, they have a specific 14-day window to give that written statement as far as that they're withholding it, how much they're withholding, and exactly what they're withholding it for.
Does the tenant, let's say before they sign the lease, are they offered, I believe, now an opportunity to inspect the apartment before they move in?
That's right. That's another change in the law. So if the tenant requests the opportunity for an inspection, the landlord is supposed to give them that opportunity and let them actually come through and have some sort of documented written understanding as far as if there are any conditions in the apartment, you know, if there was a window broken or what have you. There's supposed to be some written statement that's generated as a result of that walkthrough with the landlord and the tenant.
Now, I also understand there's a cap on the application fee, or is it really a cap on a credit report? So that, I'm not sure if it was being clarified. Is it only the credit report?
It's both. So it's a cap on application fees, including any charges for a credit report, and it limits the charges for the actual cost to run that credit report, or $25, whichever is higher, which I think in practice is going to mean an effective cap of $25.
Yeah, I think it's 20. That's okay.
I can check, right?
Yeah. So while you're looking then, what about if you're late? So I paid my rent, but I paid it late. Is there a cap on a late fee?
Yes, and this was another good change in the law. Before, late fees had pretty much been at the discretion of local courts. This limits the late fee to 10% of the rent or $50.
Yeah, whatever is lower.
Whichever is lower,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay. And then does the landlord have a responsibility on notifying their tenant if they're late? So now if you're late, and I guess the old way was if it was, you know, 3 days, I'm sending you a notice from the landlord. What did the HTSPA change that?
So it creates a new requirement that the landlord send what's considered a rent reminder once the rent is at least 5 days due. So basically, if rent is due on the first, after 5 days have passed, they're supposed to send a rent reminder notice, and that's required to be sent by certified law, sort of certified mail, and that is actually a defense to an eviction proceeding, and that is separate from the regular rent demand notice, which is generally a requirement before the landlord can actually take the tenant to court.
So there's really two notices than you would get.
There's effectively two notices, and that's the way we've seen a lot of landlords who've consulted with an attorney interpret this law, whether or not they could send one notice that meets both requirements.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah,
ambiguous.
Can you do it? Yeah, it is a little. What about renewing to your lease? Because now if you're, I think one of the reasons that this law was really for tenants is that it was kind of helping them, you know, not lose their apartment. So is there, if you're in the apartment less than a year, do you have so much notice versus if you're in there for 1 year or 2 years?
So there's a new law that requires notices if the landlord is going to either not renew a lease, that includes for month-to-month tenants, or it includes significant changes in the amount of the rent for a month-to-month tenancy. Generally speaking, before that would have been a 30-day notice, but now if a tenant has been in there more than 1 year but less than 2 years, it goes up to 60 days. And if it's more than 2 years, it would be 90 days.
Okay. What would you say are some of the pros and cons of this act? Would it be more restrictive? Is it harder for a landlord to evict? What do you think some of the unplanned outcomes are?
Well, in general, we haven't seen that it's really made it harder to evict. There certainly was some confusion immediately after the law was passed as people adjusted to the new requirements and the new timelines. But as I said before, you've now seen landlords who've consulted with an attorney adjust to those timelines, and it expands the timeline a little bit. So for example, the rent demand notice used to be 3 days. It's now expanded to 14 days. The notice of a court proceeding used to be a minimum of 7 days. It now is a minimum of 10 days. So those expand the timelines a little bit and give tenants a little bit more time, but it doesn't really make it easier to evict. I think the time generally just helps tenants either to find resources to get the money together to pay the back rent, or to find another option if they are going to end up having to move.
Yeah, okay. So before we wrap up, do you have anything else you would like to share regarding HSTP?
Yes, one other thing I'd like to point out is that the law also gives the courts discretion to, if the landlord is bringing a holdover eviction, to impose a stay while the tenant looks for alternate housing. This can be extremely valuable in situations where, due to a disability or having a large family, it might be hard for a tenant to find alternate housing. And the courts can now, in their discretion, grant a stay of up to a year while the tenant searches for alternate housing.
Okay, well, we have to wrap it up. That's the end of our housing show. Thank you, Anthony, for your time and expertise. And thank you all for listening, and tune in next week.
That was Upstate Housing with Michelle Mashurgeon. Today, she was speaking with Anthony Moen of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York.
And we close out the show with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Chris Scully, who was down in New York City on Tuesday acting up with Extinction Rebellion. He got the chance to sit down with Amelia Morgan, an XR organizer from Boston.
Hi.
So what's your name?
Amelia Morgan.
And how are you involved with Extinction Rebellion?
I'm one of two action coordinators for Extinction Rebellion Massachusetts.
Nice. And so what brings you to New York City?
A bunch of us from Boston, Massachusetts in general, came up to support what's going on here. We decided a couple months ago that our focus in Massachusetts was going to be on the week of the climate strike and not the rebellion week, which in hindsight was not the best decision, but we know now.
Yeah, why wasn't it the best decision?
Because I think the power of seeing XR all over the world take on stuff this week as opposed to the climate strike week is really powerful, and I think the feeling among coordinators seeing that happen now is very much we wish that we were a part of this. We wish that our planned action was during this week and was a part of the rebellion week.
Fair enough. What is Extinction Rebellion? How would you describe it, and what is its goal?
How would I describe it? That's kind of hard. I tell people it's an environmental organization, but I was talking to, I think, Maddie, one of the coordinators for another working group for XR Massachusetts, and she was saying calling it a movement is a lot more powerful, and it is a movement. It's not just an organization. We're in 64 countries. Extinction Rebellion has a unique approach to solving solving the climate crisis and the way we approach making change. And that's why I was pulled into it. I think having sort of a focus be civil disobedience and disruption, I was very drawn to that because over the past 20 years, nothing else has worked to stop us from reaching the 2 to 2.5 degrees Celsius tipping point. And so it was I could work on all these other environmental organizations, but it's not extreme. It's not extreme enough. For the extreme and dire situation we're in. And XR has 4 demands. And I liked that it was general enough that you could propose policies under sort of the Green New Deal. But it was specific enough that it included indigenous justice and justice for the most marginalized communities. And that's something that you see in Sunrise too, and that's awesome. But before our Sunrise, before XR, you didn't see that in environmental movements. You didn't see a focus on most marginalized communities, in terms of white people doing environmentalism. That focus wasn't there. It was a lot on policy passing and all this other stuff, even individual change, like getting people to switch over to renewable electricity, which is like, yeah, it's great, but 100 companies are responsible for 70% of global emissions. Like, mm-hmm. fixing the, like, the, well, the 30% is probably 100 more companies, right? So, like, individual change is only going to make so much of a difference. We need structural change. And so I liked the approach that Extinction Rebellion had. I liked the sort of urgency and radicalism of it, and the fact that it was explicitly inclusive of being aware about the most marginalized communities and what was going on there. And that was something that, like, I was very much looking for in an environment, in an environmental organization, was to be very clear that, like, we need to be talking about the most marginalized communities and the communities that are being hurt now, not in 10 years, like now, and 5 years ago, and 10 years ago. Like, who are the people that are being affected the most? And it's like a lot of people of color and a lot of low income people. And
if you could envision a world where we don't reach the 2.5 degree, you know, degree centigrade sort of tipping point that leads to, you know, apocalypse. Mm-hmm. What would that world look like? How would it, living in it, be different from living in this world?
Wow. I mean, that's a heavy question, but I would hope very, very, very different. I guess I can speak to U.S. specifically, like a restructuring of our government. So from everything to, like, getting money out of politics specifically to, like, making media, like, a public entity. I mean, banning cars is such a contentious issue, but putting so much of our money towards nationalized public transportation. I mean, even the fact, you know, I think about all the time, the fact you go from Boston to New York or D.C. and all three have different train systems. Like, no, we should have, you have one card and whatever, and, you know, stopping spending 60% of our budget on military, and, like, restructuring the way we interact with other countries. Yeah, taxing the billionaires. I mean, I like Bernie's plans for sure. Although I think his vision is awesome and it's a people's movement and that's great. I would even like to go further into sort of a socialist community. But I think people are very skeptical of that, and I understand that. So I think for now, like, what Bernie's envisioning and the transitions that he is proposing, I think are good. I think, yeah, but I think we could do better. I think we could do better to get rid of institutional racism. And I think that topic in particular is something that the U.S., like, really, really struggles to have a conversation around, a conversation in which, like, it's very clear what needs to be done. And, I mean that's because the people in power are mostly white. So there are a lot of people of color speaking about that, but unfortunately not enough white people, like, actually listening and actually willing to give up their privilege and willing to change their, like, mentality and implicit bias in the world. And that for me is, that's something that's, like, yeah, we really need to, like, sit down and deal with institutional racism on, like, a wide scale and have policy proposals from local government to nationwide that needs to get done. And there's so much of that, because, you know, there's institutional racism in our class system, in our education system. Like, everywhere you look, there's institutional racism. And so it seems very daunting, but it's something that I think is very much tied into the environmental movement and is, I think, the least, like, I don't know. It's just not talked about enough or prioritized enough by white people in our government.
Yeah. Now, we were speaking earlier about the importance of Extinction Rebellion taking on an explicitly anti-capitalist stance. And
yeah.
So why do you feel that that's important?
Because capitalism is most of the root of our problem. And I think think it does. I think saying it, like being explicitly anti-capitalist, does scare away people. But I personally am someone who feels like, okay, so maybe initially people are going to be scared away and not on board right away. But like, we need to make education about anti-capitalism a priority, and we need to, yeah, we need to make it an explicit agenda, because if we don't, and we are proposing citizens' assemblies and other things like that, most people aren't going to go into the citizens' assembly with the explicit idea of being anti-capitalist. And so what we might come out with is not, is policy that would be perpetuating capitalism. And that's, you know, the income inequality in the U.S. and across the globe is absolutely devastating. And it's horrifying to see, and is like so much a root of the environmental issues at hand. So yeah, I mean, I do wish XR was more explicit about it, especially in the US. I do see the other side. I do see why other people are like, no, because we want more people on board. But I feel like we got to start saying it now, and we can educate people along the way, because if we don't start saying it now, we're going to end up in a situation where people who are making decisions aren't going to be educated about it, and we're going to end up like perpetuating the current system that we're in without like radically changing it enough to work for the people. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
That was Chris Scully, who spoke to one of the organizers of the XR Action in New York City. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Spencer Keeble.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. And our engineer tonight is Sophia Cahaleen. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, send an email to info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.